I'll be disappointed if this isn't one of the best coast-to-coast shows of all time. Flotsametrics. I love this idea of studying the floating garbage patches of the world. The guy who really honed it, the guy who invented it. We're not talking to somebody else who's read about it or interested in it. This is the guy who helped create this science. And we've got him coming up next. You'll be amazed by what's floating out there, why it's floating out there, how long it's been floating out there, and what it says about us both as a planet, our past, the hope for the future, the fears for the future. They're all bobbing out there somewhere on an ocean. We'll hear about it next with the co-author of Flotsametrics and the Floating World, Curtis Ebsmeyer, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So I'm going to say, Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer, that you're my new role model.
Well, I'm not quite sure how to take that. But that's,
well, that's here's cool. Why. Here's why. I just look at the photo that comes with your book. You're tan, you're happy, you have your PhD, and you only do radio for 1 hour a week.
Well, I do 1 hour is probably partitioned into 5 or 6 segments.
Oh, are you? Okay. Well, you're going to do a lot. You're going to do a whole month's worth tonight with us. You realize that,
cool.
Don't you?
I've been looking forward to it for days.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I love this book. I love your story. And it's, so some of this is a sort of a personal memoir of how Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer got to the place where he changed his focus from kind of a sort of a traditional discipline in oceanography to this very, very cool idea of studying flotsametrics. So that's the book, Flotsametrics and the Floating World. Let me just ask you, I'm not going to be presenting the material in the same order that you do in the book. So
that's understandable.
Okay, we'll be skipping around a little bit. So let me just ask you flat out so that people understand it. How much crud is floating around the world right now?
Well, nobody really knows. It's flotsam is really undiscovered. You can't see it from space. You can't see it from a boat. It's virtually invisible out in the ocean. And the only people that really see it are beachcombers when it washes up. So the surface of the ocean, though it covers 70% of our planet, is virtually undiscovered.
Now, why is it invisible if we can see, the eye of, a president on a coin from space? How come we can't see some giant floating garbage patch out in the ocean?
Well, the ocean's moving at an average of 8 miles a day, and it's always in motion. There are always waves out there that kind of blur things. You know how it is when your subject you're photographing moves, it gets blurry. The average flotsam out there is probably the size of a dime. So it's very, very hard to see.
Yeah, but not the garbage patches themselves. Which, how big are some of these garbage patches that are floating around?
They're about, I'd say one in the Pacific between Hawaii and San Francisco is probably 3 times the size of Texas.
Okay, so you think that would show up in space?
Yeah, but it's dispersed. It's got, yeah. Mostly just small pieces. We've been trying to figure out if it changes the reflectivity of the surface of the ocean.
Right.
So far, we haven't been able to do that. So, and I would guess that most of it, if we could actually by magic do this, you'd see that most of it's the size of a grain of salt.
Well, that's, again, we're talking about kind of the difference between the individual and the aggregate, right? I mean, the smallest little pieces. That's one thing, but when you put them all together and they kind of bind together, then you're talking about something that you can, if you're in the middle of it, you can see it, right?
Well, if the waves calm down, usually okay. The waves are running 3, 4, 5 feet high, and it's very difficult to see things. Also, they don't aggregate together; they'll disperse and stay apart. It's mostly plastic now. And plastic never disappears. It just breaks down into ever smaller pieces until you get down to giant molecules or several molecules. So most of it is very, very tiny, and you have to tow a cheesecloth to actually compress it to where something you can see.
Well, or as you said, wait till it washes up on a beach somewhere, and we'll talk more about that coming up. Yeah. But then some pieces, though, I mean, some of the stuff that's floating out there, I like that story about the trees from Oregon or something that were floating by in Hawaii, and they were gigantic trees that still had the clay from the soil of the mainland still wrapped in its roots.
Yeah, that was a story from about it, the 1862 flood of California. The Sacramento Valley was covered by about 10 to 15 feet of water. There were actually steamboats running up and down the Sacramento Valley. And this great, great flood, they call it the Thousand-Year Flood, took with it trees, just immense trees that were 3-4 feet across, that crossed the diameter of the trees at the small end. And they washed out past Hawaii.
Yeah. So how do we define flotsam?
Flotsam is anything that's floating on the ocean.
Okay.
Now, so it could be like something that you can see from space.
So something as big as giant trees and something as small as these little grains of plastic that are commonly how plastics are shipped around, right? These are sort of pre-molded or pre-injection mold plastics that look like little BBs.
Exactly. They're resin pellets, and that's they're shipped that way because you can actually force them through a pipe, and they'll behave like a fluid.
So it's easy to load and download.
Exactly.
Right. So they have these ships are out there. These big container ships have the pellets. And how do they end up in the ocean?
Well, a typical container ship, over in a course of a year, probably will run into some storms. And every once in a while, a container ship will run into a storm that'll have 50, 60, 70-foot waves. And they stack the containers so high on these ships now that the ship tends to be real tippy, and it'll roll back and forth 30, 40, 50 degrees. And when it goes past about 35 degrees, the containers, these big 40-foot boxes, snap their lashings and fall overboard.
And a lot of those contain things which then end up being studied by you.
Yeah. For example, one of them can hold 15,000 Nike sneakers, and another might hold 10 million plastic shopping bags.
So this is the kind of thing that we just don't even think of. What percentage of stuff that's in the ocean sinks to the bottom of the ocean?
Well, to give you an example, plastic is about 60% of plastic will float and 40% will sink. And since many things are made of plastic, you could say roughly half sinks and half floats as just a rule of thumb. Same thing goes for bowling balls that float in the ocean. Half of bowling balls float and half will sink.
And really?
Yeah.
What does, and are there a lot of floating bowling balls out there?
It's surprising. if you ask around, the beachcombers will tell you, I got a few bowling balls, yeah.
and so that might, too, come from some giant shipment of bowling balls going across the ocean?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. That's possible, although when I talk to people, they'll say, well, I had a bad night bowling, and I went across the bridge and I just heaved it overboard,
thinking that it was going to end up in the bottom of some river somewhere. I could almost see that more with golf clubs than bowling balls.
I think there's all kinds of sources. You remember the old potato guns?
Oh yeah, sure.
So there's a community of people who go to landfills and get out old bowling balls and fire them as if they were the old potatoes. And you can take an eight and a half inch sewer pipe, and a bowling ball fits in it exactly.
Oh, no, really? Don't tell this to my teenage kids.
Okay, you're not hearing this.
Okay.
And so you put 1 pound of black powder in the bottom, and you fuse it properly, and then when you light it off, that bowling ball will go a mile.
1 mile?
Yeah, that's what I've been told.
Okay, where are these people finding a place where they can shoot a bowling ball for 1 mile somebody.
They go along the coast, and you got your own little coastal cabin, and you launch a bowling ball, and it goes out in the ocean. And
how about that, boy? You better make sure there's no ship out there, just outside of your view on the horizon.
Yeah. So suppose you're the ship, and you say, "My ship sank because a bowling ball came out of the sky." Well, you're likely to be jailed for smoking something.
Yeah, exactly. You'd have to, and especially because who would be firing off a bowling ball from a cabin? It just didn't seem like it would be so. Well, fun. Well, this again, you get the idea of what we're talking about here when we talk about flotsimetrics. And Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer has been studying this since he got into oceanography. How old are these floating garbage patches in the world?
I think they've been around for millions and millions of years. They're just a natural phenomena, and they collect anything that floats. So a long time ago, before we were putting things in the ocean, you get great trees, and you get some pumice from volcanic eruptions, and you get seeds from the tropical jungles that can float for 30, 40, 50 years. You get a lot of natural stuff, and that's what the albatrosses used to feed on. Now they're feeding mainly on plastic.
Ugh. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. But the albatross used to feed on that, meaning that they would rest on it to feed, or they were eating from those garbage patches?
Well, their feeding strategy is to glide and swoop down and pick up something that would have barnacles on it of food value and then ingest it. And their guts would take, dissolve the barnacles and get food value, and then they would regurgitate or pass through their gut the hard stuff that has no food value. That's the way they get along. And then they'd bring some of that back to their chicks back in, say, Hawaii, and regurgitate a lot of the food value into the chicks. And so that strategy is being disrupted now because much of the debris is plastic and doesn't have much in the way of food value and gets stuck in there.
Yeah,
stuck in their gullets.
I bet. And the barnacles don't attach to the plastic flotsam like it would have to more organic flotsam.
I think so, though that's still an interesting point. I'm not a biologist, but I think that's what's going on. We had one little albatross chick with 512 pieces of flotsam in its stomach when it died.
Oh, no.
And most of it was plastic, and the poor little guy just...
Yeah. Didn't have much of a chance.
No.
So, all right. So then when you say you've studied, or when you say 30, 40 years for some of these garbage patches that are floating in the ocean, that's the oldest one that's been known to be tested contained material from 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, one piece of plastic in that little albatross was dated at 60 years old.
Okay.
So the oldest piece of flotsam in a garbage patch that we know of so far is 60 years.
And these garbage patches, can they serve any good purpose? We mentioned that they're a poor source of food, but are at one time then were they part of our ecosystem?
Yeah, they still are. They collect natural debris, wood, seeds, pumice. They're a long-standing member of the natural ecosystem. It's just we're infecting it with things that we are probably harmful. So I guess that's like the blood in your body is a natural substance, but if you put things into it that are not so good, then you've infected it. So we've infected the ocean with substantial amount of garbage.
I live near the Mississippi, and there are many submerged objects, most of them natural, but some not, that people get caught on, sadly, all the time. The current moves so quickly that somebody could fall in, and then they find their body sometime later on snagged on the front hood of a car. And there's lots of floating just underneath the surface, floating logs, and that those logs often take out a boat or two because you can't see it, and they come, you hit it like a torpedo under the water. Same thing in the ocean?
Yeah, there's The closest thing I can think of is like a floating container. It'll be like a steel iceberg with a little corner sticking out, and it'll be floating maybe up to 6 to 9 months. And yachters will go, with their spinnakers up, will go streaking by, and every now and then they hit one of these containers, and their yacht sinks.
Now, this is the containers like the ones that fall off the big ships?
Yeah. Some of them will actually float for a while.
Wow, and just underneath the water, so there's no way they could see it.
And that's right. The waves will obscure it, so it's it's just like the logs, and you're talking about. You've seen those logs that every now and then they'll bob at the surface, but most of the time they're submerged, and they're like we call them out here. We call them deadheads.
Deadheads. They're just waterlogged enough that they hang below the surface.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of famous shipwrecks that have happened because they took a deadhead and went down, sadly, remarkably fast. These things destruction pretty quick on the hull. And I think that's just part of also why that was so interesting to read about how you started to study these currents. And so at any time, do these garbage patches – do they disappear from the surface and then reappear somewhere else? Do they get caught in these underwater, you know, jet streams?
Well, that's a really good question. When the wind blows, the water obviously gets mixed, and a lot of the floating plastic will get kind of mixed by turbulence, just mixed down maybe 50 feet or so, and so you don't see it. And when the wind stops and it gets glassy calm, that plastic will come right back up to the surface, and you can see it much more easily. So the wind will obscure things a lot by just mixing things down, like a deadhead, for example. You get something that's barely floating, and the wind comes along, it can get pushed down quite a ways.
Now, as you study it, these giant floating garbage patches and all, would you say our seas are generally healthy but have these floating problems in it, or our seas are worse despite all of our environmental efforts of the last 30-40 years?
I'd have to say they're far worse. It's because you can't see it. What happens with plastic is it breaks down into ever smaller pieces until it gets down to the size of maybe table salt, and then it actually mimics plankton, the base of the food chain. And that's where your small animals will eat that, and then the small fishes will eat that plankton and so forth right up through the food chain. So it's a question of, it disappears from your eyes, but it's infecting the food chain.
Is that why we have these mysterious massive fish kills we've been reading about periodically?
That's a good question. I don't know if that connection's been made, but it certainly would be one to look at. I think they've done, if under microscope, they've taken certain very small animals and have found plastic in their guts. So it's the frontier of science. What happens to all this plastic when it gets smaller and smaller and gets absorbed into the food chain?
I
can't be good.
Right, or not absorbed, and that's why it's doing this. An example of this, you know, on a larger scale, was this, you know, this container that you gave a typical example of that contained these Nike shoes. What year was that went overboard?
There were five containers holding 80,000 shoes in 1990, and the containers broke open. And 60-some thousand started floating across the Pacific and wound up here in Washington State and Alaska, and a few in Hawaii. Fourth container seemed to – it just disappeared. I think it might have sunk, but nobody knows what happened to it.
And I want to come back. I want to ask you what we learned from currents as a result of that, and the Nike shoes that are bobbing out there. And then I want to ask you about this other story that we have been covering on Coast to Coast, as I know you hear about these running shoes that show up with the occasional foot in them, right? And I want to ask you about that. And then I also want to put people on alert. Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer is not only the co-author of this book, Flotsometrics, with a guy named Eric Scigliano. But also, he hosts a radio show in which people call in and talk about all the things that they find floating or running up on beaches. It's kind of like the Antiques Roadshow for ocean currents. So all the things they found floating or all the things they found washed up. And I want to do that later on. I want to do that with Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer later on when we take some calls, is to hear what you all have found out there in the oceans and on the beaches, too. And I'll turn this book into a whole nother area, too, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Bonnet. So you can see we have sort of a nautical theme going throughout the show with our friend Kelly Sweeney, Captain Kelly Sweeney, in the first hour talking about that pirate situation, which has not moved, at least according to my news sources, since we spoke of it last. But something is moving out there on the ocean. And that are these giant garbage patches. We heard Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer say some of these garbage patches are three times the size of Texas. And they're predominantly plastic. And they're moving. They are growing, shrinking, breaking up, coming back together again. They're hitting our beaches. They're infecting our food supply in one form or another. And we just got to the part where he began to become interested in so much of this because of these Nike shoes that had fallen into the ocean after an ocean liner had lost a couple of these, a big freighter had lost some of these big, you know, box cars full of shoes. And so what did we learn about the ocean currents from that particular accident, which pushed Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer further and further into studying flotsometrics, the title of this book? And what about the shoes with the feet in them? I want to ask him where he thinks those are coming from, too, or what we can learn from flotsam in that way. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so we're talking with Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer about ocean currents and flotsometrics, the science of studying what's floating out there in the ocean. You were saying in 1990, five containers packed with Nike sneakers were swept off a cargo ship. Then there's that 28,000 floating bathtub toys spilled in the Pacific, same kind of thing. Yeah. What did we learn from all that?
Well, it has to do with salmon. A friend of mine, Jim Ingram, developed a computer model in the early days when satellites were tracking buoys, and you could track a buoy day by day for 3 months. And he developed a computer program that would simulate or actually use weather information to track, you know, the buoy movement day by day, and it was pretty good. And then one day I got information for these Nike sneakers, and I asked him, could he actually run it halfway across the ocean for like a year or two? And he never pushed his science that far. And so he simulated the drift, and I knew where the shoes fell overboard, and I knew where they washed up. And he got the match was almost perfect. So we published that in a peer-reviewed journal, and that pushed his computer model from 3 months to about 3 years, and it actually helped predictions of returns of salmon.
Well, that's the upside for that. That's good. We learn more about that. What as we look at like the floating bath, like the baby, what were they, little rubber ducks? What was the
turtles, ducks, beavers, and frogs?
Actually. That's what it was. Thank you. The whole collection of them.
Yeah, they fell overboard in 1992. And they started washing up in Sitka by thousands, and people wanted to know. And again, Jim ran his computer model, and remember that a flotsam is just something like a dead salmon without any swim speed. So he ran it for 3 years, and then we noticed that the toys kept washing up every 3 years. We get a whole flock of toys, and then he began to run his computer model all the way around for 6 years, 9 years, 15 years. Now we're up to 60 years, and so the science has developed from 3 months for the simulation of drifting buoys back in the 70s to 60 years now.
Well, so where are they now? Where are the ones that haven't washed up already. Where are they now?
The model shows them actually circling between Russia and Alaska. About every 3 years, they go around once, and that three-year orbit is about the return of salmon. So we're starting to see that the Great Circle of Currents that runs between Alaska and the Soviet Union, that's three-year orbit, has to do with the returns of salmon.
These floating toys, these floating shoes, brings us inevitably to this conversation about the floating shoes with the feet in them. any thoughts about where are these shoes that we've been covering on coast to coast that keep washing up to the shores? I believe it's British Columbia, right?
Yeah, there's been seven shoes, to my knowledge, in the year 2007, 2008, seven shoes with feet in them. And then there's one hoax with an animal paw in it. So
okay. What do you, knowing what we know about the models of these currents based on the Nike shoe drift or the bath toy drift, where do we think they're coming from?
Well, it has to do, you have to go back and say, how many missing people are there in British Columbia? And it turns out there's 2,400. And so far, these seven shoes that have washed up with feet have been traced to about three or four, perhaps five people by DNA. So we're dealing with a very, very small number. Knowing what we know, we'd have to guess that the people met their end near population centers, or they fell from boats. And the currents sweep from the Strait of Georgia off Vancouver, the city of Vancouver. They sweep out south through the Strait of Juan de Fuca into the Pacific Ocean, and they seem to be following that pattern.
So we can assume from this, to at least to some degree, that the bodies are decomposing, but because the feet are attached to the shoes, that the shoes will continue to float along these current lines.
Exactly. If you look, the bodies come apart at the joints. There's something like 20 parts, and the parts that will float for a long time would be the feet, because they're encased in flotation devices.
All right. So then can we assume... would we be able to make the same assumption that these feet, or these Nike shoes or these running shoes with feet in them, went all the way to Russia and then back again?
Well, I'm not sure that they'd survive that long. The longest we've have so far is about a year or so.
Okay.
But you raise a good question. It's undoubtedly some of the feet in the shoes escaped into the Pacific Ocean, and from there they'd head down to Hawaii and over to Japan and back, and that takes about 6 years.
So that theoretically, then, if somebody were missing 6 years ago, right, fell overboard somewhere,
yeah,
that the foot has, with the shoe on it, has already been to Hawaii, maybe careening off a coastline somewhere in Japan, going up to Russia and then back down to us?
Yep, something like that. That's about right.
Okay.
The best example I have is a skeleton was found in a survival suit in Hawaii in 1982, and the gentleman had been drifting for, best the coroners could tell, it was 2 years. So we think he fell overboard, at least I do, fell overboard in the Arctic Ocean. He drifted down past the Soviet Union over to California and then south to Hawaii. And that's about a two-year drift of 7,000 miles. And when he washed up, there were barnacles in his eye sockets, and there was still some, the legs were still fairly fleshy. So it's possible that a foot and a sneaker could go around, although probably doubtful. It's a bit long.
Right. So the British Columbia sneaker wash up with these seven different shoes with feet in them, they're going to end up, if somebody fell in off the coast of California, they wouldn't end up in British Columbia?
No, the currents from there, from offshore California, say San Francisco, run out to Hawaii. It takes about a year drift. In fact, I get calls when mariners fall off yachts and the yacht goes away. It doesn't usually sink. There's so much flotation, and so the yacht goes out to Hawaii. And I've had a number of yachts just go out in the garbage patch. I would guess there's probably a dozen yachts in the garbage patch.
In the one that's in the Pacific?
Yeah, the one between Hawaii and San Francisco.
Why aren't they retrieved?
Well, it's a long ways out, and the ocean is really huge. There's even an old iron ore carrier out there, 500 feet long, that the Coast Guard can't seem to get a handle on. So
get out.
The models aren't that good, and by the time you think you know where it is, and by the time you get out there after a couple of weeks, it's moved somewhere else. The ocean, just imagine looking for a Boston whaler in the state of Texas.
Well, and I get that, but I mean, again, we think with what the satellite imagery, once they've found it once, they would be able to track that more easily.
Well, when I work in the field of satellite tracking, you start getting into dollars real fast, and you start getting into technical difficulties. For example, suppose you were lost on a yacht out there, like in Castaway, and I wanted to find you, it would cost me probably $3,000 or $4,000 for one image, but that image would only cover an area maybe 50 miles on a side.
Okay.
So yeah, now I'm faced with the prospect of getting 100 of those images to find you. So I spend all those hundreds of thousands of dollars, and by the time I say, I know where Ian is, now when I go out there, you've moved.
I've moved, right.
Now I got to spend that money all over again.
Yikes.
And when I work with the best spy satellites, the smallest pixel they can give me is 10 feet on a side.
Yeah, but that would be enough to find a 500-foot iron ore ship.
Yeah. But the trouble is that to process those images is really labor-intensive, and by the time you find out where it is and you get out there, it's moved.
Yeah.
You can't do these satellite stuff in real time yet. It's just too expensive.
Shouldn't we be very specific here and say that, though, if we're talking about the iron ore ship, that we're not talking about flotsam anymore. Now we're talking about jetsam.
Well, that's a really good point. Flotsam and jetsam really don't cover much of what's floating out there. Flotsam is something that falls overboard accidentally, and jetsam is something jettisoned to sink the ship. So what if the whole ship is abandoned? Well, that's technically flotsam, or it's technically, I call everything out there drifting objects is what I do.
Right, but isn't jetsam something that still has ownership?
Technically, if the owner wants it back, then there's ownership. If the owner doesn't want it back, then it's yours. But it's a moot subject because most things owners don't want back, except if they're really valuable, like BMW motorcycles or tobacco or things.
Wait,
like that.
Wait, a 500-foot iron ore ship has no value?
It possibly would, but just getting out there and commandeering it and getting it towed back is an enormous task. So you remember that case where we had something like 2,000 Mazda cars in a ship called the Cougar Ace. The Cougar ship tilted 90 degrees on one side, and there were something like 2,000 or 3,000 Mazdas inside. And she was towed back to Portland, and the Mazdas were put in a parking lot until the insurance people said, we don't want the liability associated with faulty airbags. So they put them all in a giant shredder and shredded them all.
Oh, God, crazy. that's so interesting because to me, I think that when you've got a ship, let's say somebody had to abandon ship, that they would have a tracking device that would be already there. Just the insurance companies would want that on a ship that large, that they would be able to easily call upon that and just sort of follow it like you would with any kind of GPS thing.
Well, a lot of ships aren't so modern. Some ships are pretty decrepit. I had some friends die in an oceanographic research vessel.
No.
Out in Hawaii in a channel between Maui and the Big Island. And the ship was like, 200-300 feet long. And they went out and all of a sudden, they just disappeared. It was just almost like the Bermuda Triangle. Just all of a sudden, the sea just swallowed them up, and there was never a trace found. Not a trace.
And to this day, we don't know what happened to them?
That's right. To this day, we do not.
Oh, that's so weird.
Yeah, it's the ocean just sometimes swallows up things. You hear about waves that are big mounds of water, but you don't hear right. about big holes in the water that ships just fall in and the ocean covers them up and they're gone.
Well, aren't we talking about methane bubbles at that point where it comes up underneath and messes with the buoyancy of a craft and then...
Well, no, these boats sometimes just are gone. Literally gone. There was a ore carrier, the Derbyshire, over I think toward the Philippines. She disappeared in a storm, just gone. I think they finally found her way out deep in 20,000 feet of water. But you're talking about an enormous expense, maybe millions of dollars to go find a vessel like that. And the government looked hard for my friends on this research vessel. It was commissioned by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they spent
sure.
a gob of money, but never found anything.
Nothing. And not even, if I can use the term, not any flotsam
nothing.
Off of the ship?
Nothing.
Nothing that floated off of the ship when it went under?
No, nothing. It was
whoa,
very, very, very strange.
Because, I mean, that defines flotsam in the sense that things that just, as the ship would be going down, these would be the things they might have, thrown overboard or something like that in order to, lighten the load or whatever, or things that just kind of came off as it went under. And
so?
if nothing came off, I mean, it's hard to believe that nothing would have come off that ship.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. I think when you get waves like that they probably experienced, 50-foot
right.
waves, sharp crested waves, everybody's kind of hunkered down inside, but nothing.
Right.
Great, sad loss.
Very sorry. Very sad. Very interesting, Mr. Now, I know you spent a lot of your time since you were in Washington and everything on the Pacific side. What about the Atlantic side?
Oh, I spent, and as an oceanographer, I've spent time, probably equal amount of time on the Atlantic side and the Gulf of Mexico side.
Do they have the same garbage patches everywhere?
In the Atlantic, you have probably the best known one is the Sargasso Sea. And the weed out there kind of floats around.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Probably one of the oldest, in terms of evolution, that's probably the oldest adapted piece of flotsam that there is.
And the Sargasso Sea has tons of ships in it, doesn't it?
Well, I would guess so. If you look at the island of Bermuda, I've got a map downstairs that lists something like 50 shipwrecks, almost back-to-back all the way around the island. There's an incredible number of wrecks just on that one little spot. So I would guess if we could drain the Atlantic, you'd see thousands and thousands of ships on the bottom.
Well, I just thought that, too, that there's some that get caught up in the Sargasso Sea and or after they've been abandoned, they end up in it, that there's that's one of those, it's really a binding agent for ships.
Yeah, it's been going on in the 1800s, there were so many ships abandoned that the Coast Guard was called the Revenue Cutter Service back then, was going out and setting them afire because they were a hazard to navigation.
There were right, I would think so.
Hundreds to thousands of ships drifting, just drifting about, and they would go around the North Atlantic and get into the two garbage patches, one around the Azores and one around Bermuda, and just all kinds. It was a valuable source of oceanographic data back then.
But and I mean, how much of a hazard to shipping is a 500 foot long iron ore ship too? I mean, that just I'll be thinking about that for the rest of the night. You're cutting across, you're following some regular shipping lanes, and then all of a sudden, boom! Here comes some 500 foot rogue ghost ship.
Exactly. I mean, it's right out of the movie Castaway. I mean, just because Tom Hanks was drifting along on a log raft doesn't, and a ship comes by wouldn't necessarily mean that there was somebody on board.
right. And that would be even creepier, wouldn't it? If you were on a raft, like in Castaway, and you're paddling through the ocean and you say, oh, look, here comes a ship. And then it turns out to be a ghost ship in flotsam. That'd be really spooky.
Or actually, what's more likely is you'd see, aha, a ship. And it would turn out to be a yacht that's abandoned. And, you climb on the yacht, and you'd likely find enough provisions to keep going.
Very weird. And most abandoned yachts. Well, hang on. I'll ask about that coming up in just a second. And I want to spend a little more time on the Atlantic side too. We're talking with Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer, who's the world's authority on flotsam, the things that are just floating out there in the ocean, the things that are that have washed off of ships, that have some naturally occurring, but mostly now it's plastic. And the threat that it is to the environment. We'll talk more about the future, too, and what we can do about all this flotsam. Is there anything is there a solution for the flotsam that is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, these giant floating garbage patches on Coast to Coast AM next? This is Ian Punnett.